This recording is brought to you by Whitworth University. To hear additional programs, please visit www.whitworth.edu/podcast.
Welcome. Now I have your attention. It's my pleasure to introduce Julia Strunk to you this evening. She earned her undergraduate degree at Dort College and her JD at the University of Iowa College of Law. Her PhD is from the University of Maryland. Julia moved to Spokane from the other Washington, Washington, D.C., in the summer of 1994 to join the political science faculty at Whitworth. She teaches American government courses and society. Her research focuses on the relationship between faith and public policy. In 2003, she was honored with Dort College's Distinguished Alumni Award, and she was named Whitworth's most influential professor by the senior class in 2008. Julia is a regular contributor to op-ed pieces in which she analyzes national and regional legal questions and issues. Her opinion pieces have appeared not only in the Seattle Times and the Spokesman Review, but also in online editorial outlets like Cartas. If you've not already done so, you should check out Julia's podcast, If Calvin Had Coffee with a Feminist, and her blog entries on topics ranging from Supreme Court rulings on pay discrimination against women and on the challenges for Christians teaching in public schools. Julia is also author of a book in progress called So You Want to Be a Christian Lawyer, and the author of the book Law, Religion, and Public Policy, a commentary on First Amendment jurisprudence, which was published in 2002. She has professional memberships in the Citizens for Public Justice of Canada, Evangelicals for Social Action, the Christian Legal Society, and Christians in Political Science. Professor Strokes was appointed to Whitworth's Lindemann Chair in 2011. This is a rotating position for senior faculty who are engaged in significant academic initiatives and who contribute to public dialogue concerning important social issues. This is what Julius says about the Lindemann Chair. My vision for the Lindemann Chair is to engage in a speaking and writing agenda that brings together the rich history of the Reformed tradition and Christian voices of other traditions, emphasizing what we have in common and what we can learn from each other. I want to introduce a younger generation of students and scholars to the teaching of my own neo-Calvinism, but I also want to challenge neo-Calvinists to consider that others too may bring God's truth to bear on the hard questions that the world faces. Julia says of herself that all that she does in the classroom is aimed towards God's shalom in a broken world. Please join me in welcoming her as she presents tonight's lecture entitled Civil Rights for the Gay Community and Religious Freedom, Avoiding a Constitutional Clash. Please welcome her.
Thank you, Dr. Simon, and thank you so much, all of you, for coming tonight. I've been looking forward to this evening for a long time. Now, before we start this evening, I would like us to engage in an intellectual exercise that will put all of us in a framework of a frame of mind for thinking about the role of law, the rule of law in society, and what the law is supposed to do. Okay? So, imagine with me that you are out in the loop, okay, and there is nobody around. And in the middle of the loop, there is a 6-inch pool filled with water. Completely deserted. There is a little 18-month-old toddler toddling along, slips into the pool, and is struggling to get up. Now there's nobody around, and then a man comes. And a man comes and comes to the edge of the pool, looks at the baby and goes, poor baby, and goes to get dinner. All right? Baby dies. Now, the question is, should we use the law to punish this man. So discuss for 30 seconds with your neighbor. Are you inclined to use the law to punish this man for walking by and not saving the baby? Seriously, 30 seconds. Discuss it with your neighbor. Okay. Now, the hands of people who are inclined to use the law to punish the man. Where are you? All right, and now the hands of people who are inclined to say no. He was a heinous person, but we don't use the law to punish him. Where are you? Okay? So we've got two different perspectives on the law. One group of people is saying that the law is a tool to shape us, to help us be good people, to save the baby. And another group of people are saying, yeah, it's good to be a person who would save the baby, but you don't use the law to do that. All the law can really do is keep us from harming each other. Because for those of you who raised your hand secondly, I assume that you'd feel differently if the guy pushed the baby into the water and walked away, right? Okay, so the law can shape us, or the law can just protect us from harm. Keep this in mind as we go through the evening. Tonight, we're going to talk about two different groups of people. Both groups feel like they're marginalized. So one group is the gay and transgender community who are very interested in civil rights, particularly the right to be free from discrimination. The other group is a subset of the religious community, not the whole religious community, but a subset of the religious community that believes that homosexuality is deeply sinful and wrong and harmful to a community. And they also believe that when the law acknowledges the civil rights of the gay community in areas like employment law, for example, that acknowledgement hurts their own freedom of religion. So these two different groups of people both feel like they're marginalized, and when groups feel like they're marginalized, they will fight. They will fight and they will litigate. So the question for the evening is this: is there any way to broker a compromise between these two groups of people such that they recognize they actually have something in common and can work together so we don't have a big fight? And I would argue, yes, there is a compromise. I don't know if you're going to be persuaded that it's a good one, but this is what I'm going to do this evening. I'm going to lay out the law, describe some stories where you have conflict between these groups, tell you what the law says, then I'll introduce the compromise to you. And the compromise, interestingly, has some connection to Whitworth. Then I'll give you my take on the compromise, and then we can discuss. Okay? So, the first thing that we have to talk about is the conflict itself. The conflict sits in our society, but it also sits in the law. There are two different sources of law that conflict and make us confused about these different rights. The first one is the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. So, First Amendment protects it. I'm a religious person. Government does not get to pass laws that restrict my religious freedom. That's one argument. On the other hand, we have these laws that are in a lot of different states. These laws, these other laws that conflict have been proposed at the federal level, but they have not yet been successful at the federal level. However, they've been very successful in a number of states. And one of them is a law that we have in the state of Washington. And it's too big to put on the slide. I'll tell you about it and then read this quote by our state attorney general. It is a consumer protection law, and it says if you have a business and you offer a good or a service, you have to offer that business, that good or that service, without regard to a person's race or gender or sexual identity. You have to be non-discriminatory in the way that you offer that good or that service. And so our state attorney general has said under the Consumer Protection Act, which is a state law, it is unlawful to discriminate against customers on the basis of sexual orientation. So the next three stories that I'm going to tell you all originate with a conflict between two different laws like this. First, we're going to go to California. This is a couple. It's a lesbian couple. Guadalupe Benitez is the person in the story. This story takes place, starts about 10 years ago, before that child is born. Whenever you have litigation, you have like an event that occurs and then some lawsuits that are tied to it, it takes a decade to get to a resolution. So about 10 years ago, Guadalupe Benitez and her partner, Joan Clark, decided that they wanted to start a family. And so they decided that they were going to use in vitro fertilization for this family. And they went to a clinic called the North Coast Women's Care Clinic in California. The clinic is a for-profit clinic run by Christians, but it is the clinic that was connected to their health insurance. So the clinic accepts Guadalupe Benitez as a client, as a patient, and they start talking about the process. And then the people in the clinic find out that she's a lesbian. And when it comes time to do the in vitro fertilization, they say to her, "I'm sorry, we can't do this. All of our doctors are Christians. They don't believe in your family. They don't believe that they can do this in vitro fertilization for you. You have to leave." She was very angry. Some harsh words were exchanged on both sides. The doctor said, "This is our freedom of religion." She said, "I should be free from discrimination." There was a state law that was a consumer protection law, just like the one that we have in Washington. And the state law said, if you offer a good or a service in our state and you are a for-profit business, okay, so churches were exempt, religious institutions were exempt, faith-based universities were exempt. But if you are a for-profit business and you offer a good or a service, you have to do it without discriminating on the basis of gender, race, religion, sexual identity, and so forth. So a lawsuit was brought. And this lawsuit went for 10 years through the California courts, the state courts. All of the judges all along the way said that Guadalupe Benitez wins. Okay, they found against the doctors. And when they were asked, well, what about religious freedom? The court said, look, the First Amendment protects belief. You can believe whatever you want. We are not interfering with your belief. But belief is not action. We're allowed to control your action. And so believe whatever you want, but you don't get to act in whatever way that you want. So we are distinguishing between belief and action, and the doctors lose. All right? Pretty straightforward. But then we go to Michigan. This is Julia Ward. She is a conservative Christian graduate student at Eastern Michigan University in Ypsilanti, Michigan. She's a graduate student in the psych department, getting a degree in counseling. And the policy of the psych department is that they have to, the students in their practicum at the end, have to accept any clients that they're given, any patients that they're given, they just take what they get. There is a procedure for some of the students to say, I don't want this client for a particular reason, but it's hardly ever used, and they don't have very many guidelines about the procedure. Well, Julia Ward goes to the administrators at the end of her program, and she says, I am a Christian. I do not want any gay clients. I can't serve them. Give me straight ones. The administration says, forget it. That's not our policy. You will take who you get. That's our policy. She says, I won't do it. If you give me a gay client, I won't do it. University kicks her out. They expel her in the last semester of her graduate program. So the university says, we have a diversity policy. Julia Ward says, I have religious freedom. Governments, state universities should not interfere with my religious freedom. So Julia Ward brings a lawsuit. She had lawyers who advised her to bring her lawsuit in the federal courts, which was smart because federal courts in our country, by and large, are more open to religious freedom claims than state courts are. So the lawsuit started in the lowest federal court, and the lowest federal court looked at what was happening in California. And they said, well, belief and action are separate. She, Julia Ward, can believe whatever she wants, but she doesn't get to act in whatever way she wants. So the school can control her action. They can tell her, you have to take whatever patients we give you. She loses. She appeals the case to the Sixth Circuit, which is the court right below the U.S. Supreme Court in that region. And the Sixth Circuit said to the lower court, no way. You have to have at least a trial. You have to have a trial to figure out why she was kicked out. If she was kicked out because of her religious belief, you have a First Amendment problem, university. So the case goes back down to the district court, and then instead of having a trial, the parties settled it. So the university offered Julia Ward $75,000, and she took it, and she withdrew her lawsuit. If that were the end of the story, it wouldn't really be all that interesting, except that what happens next is the Michigan legislature looked at what the university did and said, that is not right. We do not like it that our state schools are discriminating against people on the basis of their religion. So the Washington legislature in the House, I mean the Michigan legislature in the House, passed a law called the Julia Ward Freedom of Conscience Act and said, no university or school may discriminate against a student on the basis of freedom of religion. Now, they passed it very quickly. They sent it to the Michigan Senate. The Michigan Senate was embarrassed by it, and they put it into conference. And it's been sitting in conference for a year and a half. So we don't know what's really going to happen in Michigan. What we do know is that the Sixth Circuit said exactly the opposite of what the California court said. They said belief and action are necessarily intertwined. If you believe something, you will necessarily act in a way that demonstrates your belief. So you cannot possibly say, we'll protect your belief, but not your action. If you're going to really protect someone's belief, you also have to protect their action. Those two things are intertwined. That's what the First Amendment means. So, when you have a debate about what the First Amendment actually means, what is freedom of religion actually mean? Does it mean protecting belief, or does it mean protecting belief and action? Who do you go to? Supreme Court. Yes, Supreme Court. I would love to be able to tell you that the Supreme Court has answered this for us, but the Supreme Court has 200 years of jurisprudential mess on the First Amendment. 200 years of a mess. So I'm going to tell you three quick stories about what our Supreme Court has done over the course of the last 150 years with respect to this belief action debate. Now, it's a complicated slide. Don't worry about that. I'm going to tell you the stories, but you can use the slide to kind of guide your thinking. All right? So we are back in Utah in 1870. Right after the Civil War, all the con law students are going, oh yeah, I remember this. George Reynolds is a Mormon, and he is a polygamist. He has many wives. There is a federal law that says polygamy is a crime. Charges are brought against George Reynolds. George Reynolds says, no, I have freedom of religion. You cannot pass a law making polygamy a crime when I have freedom of religion and this is my religious belief. Goes all the way up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court says, sorry, Mr. Reynolds, belief and action are separate. You can believe whatever you want. We protect that, absolutely. But it does not mean that you can act in whatever way you want, and you have committed a crime, the crime of polygamy. So, for about 100 years, not that much happens in freedom of religion jurisprudence. But by the time we get to the 1960s and 1970s, there's a whole slew of cases that go up to the Supreme Court, about three or four of which are directly connected to this question of belief and action. And I'm just going to tell you about one of them because it clarifies so clearly how the judges changed their mind. This is a case called Wisconsin v. Yoder. This is not our dear Dr. Yoder. It's a different Yoder. I'm sure they're relatives, though. So they are Mennonites living in the state of Washington. And the Mennonites, the state of Washington has a, Wisconsin, okay? The Mennonites living in Wisconsin, and the state of Wisconsin has a compulsory education law and says everybody has to go to school up until the age of 16. Everybody. The Mennonites say, no, not us. Our kids will go to school up to the age of 12. And after that age, they will go in the fields, and they'll go to our church, and they'll become citizens in other ways, but they're not going to go to the schools after age 12, not even Mennonite schools. They're not going to go to school after age 12. State says, you're committing a crime if you don't send your kids to school up to age 16, And the Mennonites say, well, this is our religion. You cannot pass a law, a compulsory education law, that conflicts with our religion. So the case goes all the way up to the Supreme Court, and the court hands down this ruling that is fascinating reading, and what they say is that belief and action are definitely intertwined. You can't protect belief without protecting action. If you look at what the Mennonites are doing, they are actually raising very good citizens. There's nothing dangerous about them taking their kids out of school at the age of 12. They're not violent. They're not on the streets being drunk. They're not bad citizens. They are good citizens. And so what the court does is it articulates this test that becomes called the strict scrutiny test. And it says, whenever there's a conflict between a person's religion or other rights protected by the Constitution and what the government wants to do, you do two different things to decide who wins. The first thing you do is you ask, does the government have a compelling interest? Is it really, really important for the government to have this law? And the state said, yes, absolutely. It's really, really important to have a compulsory education law. It's important partly because we want to socialize our citizens, and it's important because the citizens have to learn to read and write. But then the second piece of the test is, has the government used the least restrictive alternative to achieve its very important goal? And it was on that prong that the case failed and the Mennonites won. Because the Supreme Court said there's lots of different things that you can do to have really good citizens. Forcing the Mennonites to keep their kids in school until the age of 16, that's not the least restrictive alternative. Okay, their kids are still good citizens, even if they're coming out of school at the age of 12. So here, the court completely flips on the belief and action dichotomy and says belief and action are intertwined. Fine. If it was just a situation where the court decided one thing after the Civil War and another thing in 1960, no big deal. But in 1990, the court flipped again. In 1990, in a case that came out of Oregon, this is what had happened. There are two Native Americans, and they ingest the cactus peyote as part of their religious tradition. And these guys are drug counselors. So on the weekend, they ingest the cactus peyote, and then on Monday, they take a drug test at their drug counseling job, and they fail it, and they get fired. They get fired, and then the state says, you got fired for breaking the law. We're not going to give you unemployment insurance. And these guys said, this is our religion. First of all, we shouldn't have been fired. And secondly, you have to give us unemployment insurance just like anybody else. You can't discriminate against us on the basis of our religion. Case goes all the way up to the Supreme Court. And Justice Scalia leads the justices in tossing out the compelling interest test, saying we're going to get rid of it. And instead what we're going to say is whenever there is a law of general applicability, a state law, a federal law, law that does not target any religion, but it generally applies to everybody, we're going to let that law win and the religious people lose. Okay? So first, belief and action are separate. Then they're intertwined. Then they're separate again. And the standard is a law of general applicability wins. And it's very interesting for those of us who are Supreme Court nerds that Scalia handed down this decision, because now there's a case in Washington that's going to go up to the Supreme Court in the next 2 years, and Scalia is going to be caught. He's going to be caught because he articulated this standard of law of general applicability, but he does not like laws that protect gay people. He just does not think that gay people should have laws that protect them. So what is the case? Anybody here from the Tri-Cities? Okay, so Richland, do you know Arlene's Flower Shop? You've seen it. Okay, Arlene's Flower Shop, this case has made international news. Arlene's Flower Shop is not owned by Arlene. It's owned by Baronelle Stutzman, which I think is funny, just in and of itself. Baronelle Stutzman. So Baronelle does lovely flowers, and she has lots and lots of clients. And she sells clients to gay people and to straight people and to all kinds of people. And one day, one of her gay customers comes in with his partner, and he says, Baronelle, we are so excited. We are getting married. We have to have you do the flowers. You're the best. And she says, oh, no. Oh, I'm so, so sorry. I'm a Christian. My faith prevents me from doing same-sex marriage flowers. My faith prevents me from being engaged in same-sex weddings in any way. So the two guys are very sad. There's no harsh words exchanged. They go home. They tell their friends about this. The friends are irate, as I understand it. The friends call up the Washington Attorney General. And remember, the state of Washington has this consumer protection law. And it says if you offer a good or a service, if you're a business and you offer a good or a service, you have to do it with non-discrimination. You can't discriminate on the basis of sexual identity. And so our attorney general brings a claim against Baronelle Stutzman. Baronelle Stutzman says, no, this is my religion. As I understand it now, she's holding firm. Her business has gone through the roof because a lot of people are in support of her. And the attorney general is continuing with the claim. So you have this, her, Baronelle Stutzman's argument that the First Amendment protects her religious freedom and protects her from state laws that regulate her religious freedom. And then you have a state law that says consumer protection, you cannot discriminate in your selling of goods and services. And this is going to go up to the Supreme Court. And we're expecting either this or a case that involves a baker or a photographer. There's a whole lot of these cases percolating all across the United States. And this is going to go up to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court is going to have to choose whether they want to do the belief and action are intertwined or the belief and action are separate. So what are the possible outcomes? This issue of the subset of religious people versus the gay community is not going to go away. It is the First Amendment litigation future. All you have to do is look at abortion and affirmative action to know that even if you have a case that's been decided, that is not the end of the story. Decades and decades and decades will go by with lots and lots of litigation. So one thing we can do is just litigate. All the lawyers will get rich. All of us who are fascinated by these cases will read them and be interested in them and teach them to our students. But people will really get hurt along the way. So the other question is it possible to have some kind of brokered political compromise? If you had a political compromise, what might it look like? Okay, so let me just describe what a political compromise might look like, and then we can talk about it. Go back to the baby in the pool that we started with. The question is, can you live in a world where the government says even people with objectionable worldviews are allowed? They're allowed in the public square. They're allowed, as long as they do not hurt other people, they're allowed in the public square. So our conversation is about when does hurt occur? That's where we legislate, when harm occurs, not because we think someone should live a particularly moral life, but because a person has caused harm. Okay, if you can live in that world, then some kind of compromise might be possible. So the compromise that has been floating around in this state it's really just started. There are some legislators here in Spokane and Spokane Valley who have worked with a Gonzaga law professor, and they have come up with this Religious Freedom Restoration Act. A lot of states have this. It is a codification. So you take the strict scrutiny test from the Wisconsin v. Yoder case, and you put it into a statute, and you make it the law of our state. It's very possible they'll be successful with that. But that by itself isn't going to get us anywhere, because all it does is it tell us that you have to think about a compelling state interest and you have to balance it. So we need another step after that. And in order to put sort of the meat on the next step, I'm going to tell you one more story about a Washington lawsuit. So this is not a lawsuit that involves the gay community, but it's a lawsuit that involves the religious pharmacists who have a disagreement with the State Board of Pharmacy. Thriftway is a pharmacy in our state. This one is in Tacoma. And our State Board of Pharmacists have a rule that say if you are a pharmacist, you have to provide all the medication that your clients need. You have to provide it. But then they said, if you have a business reason not to provide something, like if it's really expensive, you have an economic reason not to provide it, then you can have a policy of refuse and refer. We can't provide it for you, but you can get this drug down the street at this other pharmacist, All right? Refuse and refer. So this guy, and that's the only reason, like convenience and business reasons. So the guy that owns the Thriftway pharmacy says, I'm a Christian. I'm being asked to carry Plan B. Now, you know what Plan B is? It's a, I get the science wrong, but it's a pill that you take after sex in order to not become pregnant. And there are a lot of people who think that it is an abortifact, that it will cause abortions. And he says that he does not want to provide Plan B in his pharmacy because it violates his religious freedom. Well, the State Board of Pharmacists bring a claim against him, and it's a lawsuit, and the lawsuit goes to the federal court. And it's heard by Judge Ron Layton. And Judge Layton is an alum of Whitworth. And he hasn't been a federal judge for all that long, and he's conservative, and he was appointed by a conservative, and people expected him to be conservative. But one of the interesting things he did was he was the very first judge to say that Don't Ask, Don't Tell by the military is unconstitutional. So that kind of threw people off in terms of his worldview. So he gets this case, and he looks at it, and he says, look, the pharmacy board has said there are some exceptions. If somebody doesn't want to provide a certain drug, there are some exceptions, and they're making an exception for business. So if they're doing that for business, they have to be willing to do it for religion too. You can't say only religious people have to give all the drugs. If you're going to let people have some exemptions, you have to give exemptions to people who have religious objection, and they get to have the same refuse and refer perspective. Now, what happened just recently, this is a publication that came out this week. Another alum of Whitworth, Peter Dolan, is a law student at the University of Washington Law School. And he wrote a comment for their law review that just got published. And he took this case, Judge Layton, he didn't even know Judge Layton was one of his fellow alum. So he took this case and he crafted a 5-part exemption saying if we want to offer a political compromise, what we should do is we should come up with a way in which everybody obeys this rule that the consumer protection law, where you give goods and services, you don't discriminate as you're selling your goods and services, but we're going to make an exemption for some people. Because of the First Amendment, we're going to make an exemption for people who really, really, really have a religious objection to this. So we're going to have pluralism in the public square. For the most part, we're going to have justice to all the people so that they can all buy the goods and services, but if someone has a very strong religious objection to something, we will carve out an exemption for them. And this is Peter Dolan's 5-part refuse and refer compromise. So we'll just see what you think. People like Baronel Stutzman should be allowed to discriminate if they meet this 5-part test. First, the services are personally rendered. So there's a recognition that for Baronel to actually put the flowers together and actually bring them to the church of a same-sex wedding and actually engage in artistic design with a same-sex couple, that involves her personally. So if you're personally involved and you object to it, that's the first part of the exemption. The second part is we should only have exemptions for small service providers. Because if you have a really big service provider, if you have a flower shop that hires 500 people, well, you can find somebody else to do the same-sex wedding. You don't have to do it yourself. So a small service provider, like maybe 10 employees. Okay, depends on the compromise. Second, open advertisement. You have to put it in your window that you object to certain kinds of services, certain kinds of clients. You have to be upfront about it so the market can take care of it. So if the people don't like it that you do this, they will go to a different florist. Fourth, no insults or hate speech. Okay, you don't get this exemption if you're going to enter into insults with clients. And then fifth, you have to refer them to somebody who will help them. Okay, it's this 5-part test. Now, what do you think? Lots of people object to it, but if you are a pluralist, if you're thinking about pluralism, compromise is where you kind of need to go to make room for different people of different perspectives. Now, I'll tell you what I think about this. I am a pluralist. I really believe in worldview pluralism. I used to believe if I had enough power, I could make everybody be the way I want them to be. But it doesn't work. You know, it just doesn't work. It ends up in fights. And so now I believe in pluralism. And pluralism has its roots in Catholic subsidiarity and in Reformed sphere sovereignty. It has its roots in Christian biblical thinking about how you organize a group of people who have different sorts of worldviews. But I would say that this recognition of pluralist worldviews is only half the story. Okay, it is worldview pluralism for one group. It's worldview pluralism for conservative Christians. But what about the other group? Okay, my argument would be if you're going to move in this direction and have this kind of a compromise, there is an obligation that goes along with this sort of pluralism. And the obligation is that you work very, very hard to make sure that there is pluralism for the other side. In this case, the gay and transgender community, such that Christians, liberal and conservative Christians, should be the very first people out of their seat to fight on behalf of the gay community in terms of employment law and housing law and marriage. Okay, Christians should be out there saying, this is what it means to do justice. Because what is gay marriage other than a different sort of view of what it means to be human and what it means to operate in a community than the conservative Christians? It's a pluralism of worldview. Okay, so if you're going to go in this direction, this is the argument I've been making. Doesn't really sway that many people, but Christians, both left and right, should have aggressive support for the rights of the LGBTQ community, including same-sex marriage. That's what I think. Now, when I give parts of this talk in different venues, you would say, so who agrees? Who agrees? A year ago, I gave this talk to at GLAMA, Gay Lesbian Medical Association, and all through the talk, they're like, man, that is not good for us. We do not like that. But at the end, they were quite persuaded. Because what they said was, look, we know what it's like to be a minority. And we know what it's like to feel like you have to fight. And so we recognize that conservative Christians also feel marginalized. And as long as the deal is that we get people arguing on our behalf, we can see that there should be room made for people who disagree with us. The people who really don't like this are, and as I've been giving these lectures, have been some groups of Christians. They've said, man, I was with you all along. I believe in pluralism. This is going to be great. Conservative Christians should have pluralism. I was with you all along up until that last bit where you said fight on behalf of gay and lesbians, because I believe in pluralism when I'm in the minority because that protects me. But I don't believe in pluralism when I'm in the majority. Why would I go along with it? I already have it the way I want. Then I believe in majority rule, and so does God, right? And once they play the God card, you're just kind of stuck. So that's the story. That's the compromise. That's my take on the compromise. Thank you all so much for coming. I really appreciate it tonight.